This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. At the state level, it's been labeled a public health emergency by Florida's governor, and nationally, the CDC has declared it a national opioid epidemic. The United States' problem with opioid addiction has reached critical levels, as predictions show more people potentially dying from overdoses than traffic accidents and guns on a daily basis. That's according to the Florida Alcohol and Drug Abuse Association. Lawmakers are scrambling to come up with answers, and the search for a magic medicine to make it all better has led to a $15 million allocation for the drug naltrexone, which is sold for roughly $1,000 a dose under the brand name Vivitrol. Still, that medication is just one tool in the treatment toolbox, and it's getting the lion's share of funding from state lawmakers who, according to Politico Florida, have allocated nearly $15 million of the state's treatment dollars for that drug. Joining us now to understand how Southwest Florida is treating the crisis in opioid addiction and how those programs will be affected by this shift in spending towards Vivitrol is Maggie Baldwin. She's the director of the Crossroads Continuum Adult Substance Abuse Program at the David Lawrence Center in Collier County. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
Also joining our program today is St. Pete Representative Kathleen Peters. She's here to discuss how Florida lawmakers changed up mental health care spending and what is in the works to remedy spending cuts that some lawmakers say they didn't see coming. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We are talking about the use of Vivitrol for opioid addiction and what other services are still needed, but unfunded by budget decisions in the Florida State Legislature. Call in with your thoughts at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. First, Maggie Baldwin with the David Lawrence Center. Tell me about how you are using the medication naltrexone, which is sold under the brand name Vivitrol, to treat opioid addiction.
Okay, well, we are using that at David Lawrence as part of our continuum of care for folks who have substance use disorders. So, for example, if somebody is on our substance abuse residential unit and they're interested in it, they might be able to go over to our med services and be evaluated and be started on the medication.
Now, how does it work?
Okay, so naltrexone, which is the oral pill, daily pill, and Vivitrol is the monthly injectable version of naltrexone. It's an opioid antagonist. So it works for folks who have opioid use disorder or alcohol use disorder. And it's a blocking medication. So it attaches to opioid receptors but doesn't activate the brain's pleasure response. So in other words, if a person is on Vivitrol but they use heroin or some other opioid or drink alcohol, they will not feel the euphoric effects. They won't get high.
So it won't be worth it for them.
Correct.
Could they continue to take more and more, thinking if they take more, they'll feel the effects and then end up hurting themselves?
Yes. There's always a risk of that, and clients are educated on those risks.
Okay. That's good. So do you find people go more for the 30-day shot thing because it's easier because you don't have to remember taking a pill every day?
Yes. That is one of the benefits.
Okay.
The research shows that people who are on a monthly injectable have better adherence. You know, and there's a steady stream of it in the person's bloodstream.
Better adhere. It sticks better.
Yeah, basically.
It sticks.
Yeah.
So does it work for everyone?
Well, it's not a one-size-fits-all. I mean, you have some people who don't want to be on a medication. You have some people who started and maybe have some mild side effects and discontinue. But then we've also seen some great success with the medication. So again, it just depends on the person. We take a very individualized approach.
So if someone came to you and they just did this injectable for every 30 days, what else do they need?
Well, they need a whole continuum of care. In other words, they need some psychosocial treatment, group therapy, individual therapy, because to be in recovery means to develop new behaviors. So it's behavior change, new ways to cope with maybe some distorted thinking. A lot of our clients have co-occurring disorders that need to be addressed.
Things like depression?
Absolutely. Trauma, post-traumatic stress disorders, dysfunctional relationships. They need living skills. So, and we do educate clients about the disease of addiction because it is a disease. So it's more than just the medication. That's a great intervention and a great tool, but it's more than that.
As one tool in the toolbox, like
absolutely.
We were talking.
Mm-hmm.
So, Representative Kathleen Peters, I wanted to ask you about how our state funds opioid treatment. Last month, we learned that Florida was going to be losing access to more than $24 million in federal grants for mental health care, including opioid addiction. But then there was news of $27 million coming in specifically for opioid addiction. Was that $27 million a result of Governor Rick Scott's emergency declaration for opioid addiction to our state?
The $27 million was a direct result of Governor Scott's actions declaring an emergency. But there's a discrepancy. There's a problem. So it was $20.4 million of federal money that we had to provide residential facilities, beds, detox, counseling, and all the continuum of care that's necessary for this to be successful. And unfortunately, we lost $20.4 million to do all of that. Now, the $27 million that the governor brought in is specifically designed for medical-assisted treatment for something like Vivitrol or Suboxone or Methadone. And without, you know, both of those, you know, the Suboxone and the Vivitrol, they have found to be very successful. However, without the accompanying rehab and psychosocial and residential facilities for people to be in while they're going through this treatment, the success, I don't believe, is going to be as successful without those other services. And the unfortunate part about that is we were already underfunded for those services before we lost the $20 million. So there's great concern among many of us in the legislature that we took a huge step backwards, and regardless of this $27 million, it won't be enough. And so there's several of us that are calling on action for the governor to get another federal grant or federal funding to not only replace the $20.4 million that we've lost, but maybe enhance that. And there's other things that we can do in rural that we can take action right away on. So, and so, as a matter of fact, I'm calling the governor today to have that conversation with him.
Well, so I'm curious, though. I want to go backwards. How did the legislature lose $24 million? Is that money sitting on a table that nobody applied for the grant for, or what?
It was federal money that we get. And we get a lot of federal money, these block grants, for Medicaid and other kind of medical assistance. And although it says it's not recurring, it often is recurring. And so what happened this year is they say, oh, it's not going to be there, it's not recurring. But every year the federal government always gives us those block grants. And so although we knew that it was not going to be recurring, there were very few of us that actually knew it was factual. A lot of people made it with the assumption that, oh, it's non-recurring, but we're going to get it anyway. And what happened is we didn't get it. And so everybody was caught by surprise, and the session was over, and the budget was already done, and we didn't know that we really truly were going to lose that money. It doesn't sound like this makes any kind of sense, but the truth of the matter is, just like our Medicaid, it says every year it's not recurring, and typically we always get our Medicaid dollars from the federal government. So it really did catch several of us by surprise. There were a couple of people in the House of Representatives that knew about it. They've said that they knew about it, but they didn't bring it to our attention to replace those dollars.
So it was rumored to be ending?
I'm trying
to understand. So it was rumored to be ending. Everybody said it was not going to be recurring, although that's happened in years past, and it always ended up recurring anyway.
Right.
So the lawmakers were kind of going along on the assumption that this year was going to be just like every other year, and they're going to say, oh, it's not coming back, but it will somehow, like an 11th hour
that's
deal?
Pretty much. I know it sounds like it doesn't make sense and it's not common sense, but that's actually how it works. And there was really no, as far as I knew, I was not aware, the providers weren't aware, the managing entities that do the contracts were not aware that this was not going to come.
When did we find out it was really, for real, not going to happen?
In June. It was far after the budget process was over.
That was after the special session and all of that. So the whole budget was made and created and approved based on the assumption that that $20.4 million was going to be there.
That's my opinion. Now, Chairman Broder has said that he knew and he thought there was enough money in there to cover it, but the money that was in there was not for the same kind of services. So there wasn't money in there to cover the loss.
And then when you look at the difference here between $20.4 million and $27, it sounds like you're $7 million ahead, but these are different dollars and they're earmarked in a different way because of that emergency declaration?
Yeah. So none of that $27 million can go for the beds or for the rehab or for the counseling. And just for an example, if you don't mind me going on a little tangent, but just for an example, if we lose in Pinellas County, I'm going to take one program. Because $20 million across the state is a lot of programs are closing as a result of the cuts in funding. And so I have 10 beds in Pinellas County that's going to close for pregnant women who are addicted to opiates. Now, that's 50 women a year that are not going to get services to ensure that their baby is born healthy and not addicted to drugs. So So those 50 women, if they deliver their babies healthy, that is at least 50 babies that will be born in Pinellas County that will be addicted to drugs. Now, the cost to you and me, to the state, to help those babies get off of their addiction is a minimum of $280,000 per baby for the first 2 months. If we can get the baby weaned off of its addiction within 2 months, often it takes 6 months. So that child, just like anybody else, will then need psychosocial and other kind of therapies for the rest of their growing childhood developmental years. And so the if they feel that that's a saving, that's crazy, because that $1 million that they might lose, it's not even $1 million, it might be $500,000 that they're losing those 10 beds. But the cost to the state to take care of the 50 babies that are going to be born addicted to drugs is going to far exceed the $500 we just cut.
Well, and then when
it's not even good fiscal sense to not continue funding those beds.
And then when you multiply that out with not just your community, but the communities across the state of Florida,
yes,
that will total more than $20.4 million.
Exponentially more.
We are talking about opioid addiction and how treatment is funded in Florida. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. So, Maggie, the declaration we were talking about by Governor Rick Scott, his emergency declaration, ended up netting $27 million coming to the state of Florida. How has that changed anything about the way things are working at Crossroads with you and your patients?
Okay, so with that, those specific dollars for clients who have opioid use disorder, we have been able to hire a substance abuse case manager. And the criteria to be in the program with the case manager is to have an opioid use disorder, to be interested in medication-assisted treatment, whether through Vivitrol, Suboxone, or Methadone, and have no other funding source.
So, and that's for patients that have no other coverage?
Correct.
And that it's only for patients that don't have Medicare, Medicaid,
correct,
and don't have their own insurance?
Yes.
But who are the people that are actually coming to you with opioid problems?
It's a spectrum of different people. I mean, we have clients from every socioeconomic background, education level. We've had clients who have been homeless, indigent, to professionals, nurses, teachers, you know, your quote-unquote soccer moms, business professionals. So the disease of addiction does not discriminate. It is an equal opportunity destroyer.
And there are a lot of people that have a misperception about people that are addicted to anything and
yes,
consider it kind of junkie time,
yes,
and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And just to kind of say here to what the representative was saying, we also have had women in treatment who are recently postpartum or pregnant, you know, who desperately want treatment, who desperately want to break the cycle of addiction, who are in treatment so they can be reunited with their children and their families.
So the additional funding that you've gotten is very focused on a medical angle.
Correct.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Have you, because of the earlier loss of $20.4 million, have you experienced some cuts and setbacks in other ways, such as counseling or emergency beds for children in crisis, things like that?
Well, I think just in general, there haven't been rate increases in many years. So it's hard to expand services. We're kind of keeping things status quo, but it is difficult to expand services.
Mm-hmm. So Representative Kathleen Peters, lawmakers this past session set aside almost $15 million to pay for Vivitrol treatments. How much of our state's overall opioid funding does that make up?
I can't give you that total and that percentage. I'd love to say I can, but I can't. And we are also using Vivitrol in our prison system to help people when they get out of prison to not continue that cycle of addiction. So we really are attacking this problem, but there's so many other ways in which we can attack this problem. And a lot of that is not necessarily money per se. I'm very disappointed about the money, and I'm advocating to get the money replaced and enhanced. But there's other things that we can do because it's really educating doctors on how they're prescribing. And I was just at the VA hospital the other day, and they were talking about what they're doing on this crisis. And what they have found is a great big problem is that people are dying because of opiate, and it's being classified as dying over an opiate overdose. But a lot of times, doctor will prescribe pain medication, and then that patient will go to a different doctor, and they'll get prescribed benzodiazepine, which the combination makes somebody's respiratory system completely shut down, and that's how we're losing them. Now, that death will be associated as an overdose of opiates, and yet it was the misprescribing of doctors. And so there's other things that we can do that can change the outcome of the people that are dying, because we're losing 14 people a day in the state of Florida. You know, and it really is because of the prescription and the way they're being prescribed.
Mm-hmm. I am curious, though, about what percentage of the overall budget towards opioid is going towards just one medication. And I wanted to play a brief news story from a reporter named Julio Ochoa, where he cites a report by an online news outlet called Politico. And it traced more than $156,000 in campaign contributions in Florida in 2016 to Alkermes, which makes Vivitrol. Let's take a listen to that.
Alkermes, which makes the opioid treatment Vivitrol, found success promoting the drug in Florida. Last year, the company gave $50,000 to Senate President Joe Negron. He was instrumental in securing $10.5 million for Vivitrol's use in the state's criminal justice system and in treatment facilities. Mary Lynn Ulrey is CEO of DACO, a treatment facility in the Tampa Bay area. She was surprised to see funding for the drug after the House had removed it.
I've never seen the head of the Senate so keyed up on doing something for addictions before, except that he really loved this Vivitrol idea.
Still, Ulrey says she's happy to get any funding for addiction treatment, including Vivitrol, which works well for some patients.
Now, we don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth, but I do want to ask Representative Kathleen Peters, how did that Vivitrol money end up going into the budget? Did that happen during regular session or special session?
That happened during negotiations with the Senate President and the House and the Speaker of the House, because the House did not put it in. The woman in that interview is correct, and it was a push by Senator Negron. But you know, someone can link that to a campaign contribution and make and you know go there and say that, but that is not the intent of the Senate or Senator Negron, because Senator Latvala was another one that was pushing that. Because this is really passionate. He is very passionate about this. He is very upset that we're losing 14 people a day in the state of Florida to overdose. So I don't think it's a fair assumption. I mean, many of us get contributions from many organizations, but that doesn't mean that drives what we do. Now, I was disappointed in the article I saw that said of the $27 million that the governor brought down, Big Pharma was the one that won, because $24 million of that $27 or $23 million. The bulk of that money is for pharma. It's for Vivitrol. It's for Suboxone. It's for methadone. And so that's really where the bulk of it's going to pharma. But the bottom line is Vivitrol works.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a gift horse in the mouth is absolutely, it works. Now, there's other things that we can do to prevent people from having to get to that point. We can do other therapies. We can... the state of Ohio made certain surgeries, back surgeries, that are not very successful. They can't even do those until they do other methodologies first. So there are things that we can do, whether it's prescribing and doctors having to look at the PDMP and then forcing doctors, not just voluntarily, but forcing them to report whenever they prescribe so that they can do cross-references and not prescribe an opiate if they're taking the benzo, whatever that name was. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me to pronounce it correctly. But, you know, we can't be having two different doctors prescribing for one patient when it makes a mixture of poison for somebody to make their heart stop beating and their respiratory system to shut down.
So
there's other things we need to do other than just investing in pharma.
Yeah, and so what I'm wondering then is that $20.4 million that kind of disappeared, is there anything that's possible to bring that back?
Yes, there is. And matter of fact, Senator Latvala has sent a letter, and my letter and the phone call to the governor is going to follow up on his letter. And he is specifically asking the governor to expand that emergency that he has done and the executive order that he has done. And under that executive authority, under Chapter 252, he can then put more money, just like he did the $27 million, he can request for more money to be put in to address this right away. So the senator has requested that he put $20 million back in, $5 million for detox centers, $9 million for residential treatments, $3 million for outpatient and recovery support, $6 million for specialized services, and $2.4 million for prevention. And that really just replaces what we lost. That doesn't get us ahead of the game, but it replaces what we lost. And so I'm following up with letters, and we are asking our constituents across the state of Florida to email, write, and call the governor and demand that he do this to save lives.
All right, and then I want to turn again now to Maggie Baldwin in the studio from the David Lawrence Center. According to a Senate committee, it costs an estimated $15,000 to $40,000 to treat opioid addiction per person. Does that sound right to you, or how much does that vary from person to person, and what part of that is going to be the counseling and an emergency bed, perhaps, and detox?
I think it does vary person to person, you know, based on what levels of care the person is in. I can tell you that for clients who have any legal issues, being in treatment is definitely more effective and more cost effective than being incarcerated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a recent study from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, every dollar invested in addiction treatment program yields a return of between $4 and $7 in reduced drug related crime. So when savings related to healthcare are included, total savings can exceed costs by a ratio of 12 to 1.
12 to 1. And this is kind of similar to the discussion that Representative Kathleen Peters was saying about treating women who are pregnant and saving mm-hmm. money in the long run.
Correct.
So there are some big picture things to consider when talking about these types
yes.
of investments.
Yes.
The estimate that she said is, I think, is low because we know the number one reason children are taken away from their families and put in state custody is mental health and addiction.
Mm-hmm.
We know the number one thing sucking the resources out of the court system, the jail system, the prison system, and the law enforcement system is mental health and addiction. And we also know the number one thing driving up cost of health care is mental health and addiction. So I think, and I know those were estimated numbers that she quoted, but I believe that those are low.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at September, the next time lawmakers get together. What kind of timeline do you think? Do you think it can be turned around pretty quickly to get this funding back?
As far as if the governor were to go to the federal government, and the truth is the federal government declared an emergency several weeks ago, and yet it still hasn't been codified and money hasn't come out.
Okay.
So I think if our governor acts quickly, and if he asks for more money from those resources, I think we can get it turned around quickly once the federal government does what they need to do to get that codified.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there for now, but I do want to thank our guest, Maggie Baldwin with the David Lawrence Center, and also Representative Kathleen Peters from St. Petersburg. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, this is the weekend of barbecue, and who better to grill on the subject than Fort Myers chef and pitmaster Ruben Silva, whose former restaurant ranked number 4 in the country among the best barbecues around. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.